I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a low-key ceremony at the White House this morning, President Bush signed a bill that authorizes 700 miles of additional fencing along the U.S.-Mexico border.
The bill I'm about to sign is an important step in our nation's efforts to secure our border and reform our immigration system. I thank the members of Congress for joining me as I sign the Secure Fence Act of 2006.
Well, it's not the bill the president wanted. It doesn't contain his guest worker program or provide a path to citizenship for some immigrants. And in fact, the president reportedly didn't want to sign the measure publicly at all. But Republicans, hoping for a boost before the elections, persuaded the White House to reconsider. Joining us on the line from Washington is Los Angeles Times reporter Nicole Gawet, who's been covering immigration reform since it became a hot political topic. Nicole, what specifically is in this bill?
Robin, it's a short bill. It orders the Department of Homeland Security, or DHS, to gain operational control of the border within 18 months. Congress hasn't defined what operational control means, but they're expected to do so when they reconvene. It also details exactly where the 700 miles of fencing should go along the southern border, and that is down to the mile.
Now, you mentioned it says down to the mile where the fence is. Could you distinguish for us, because we have reported on the virtual fence, which is the high-tech, you know, using cameras and detectors, sort of invisible fence. This is the solid fence. Where is this going?
Yeah, it would be at least a double-layered fence. And in the bill originally as written, they have it surrounding cities in California, in Arizona, cities like Douglas, New Mexico, El Paso, Texas. But it's very important to note that on the day that the bill was passed in Congress, the Republican leaders of the House and Senate sent a letter to one Texas Senator, Kay Bailey Hutchison, and then the leaders of the Senate and House Judiciary and Homeland Security Committees. And the letter, in effect, it doesn't gut the bill, but it makes it a lot fuzzier. It says that they will work when they reconvene to give the DHS Secretary, Michael Chertoff, the flexibility to decide whether he wants to use physical infrastructure or technology. Many observers believe that we're not going to end up with 700 miles along the southern border.
Well, in fact, is there money in the bill to pay for it?
No, there is not. And that is interesting. Congress passed a $33 billion Homeland Security funding bill earlier this month. It contained $1.2 billion for border security, but estimates for the fence per mile range from $3 million to $10 million. I think the total cost is estimated to be anywhere between $2 billion to $9 billion. So yeah. Money is a problem.
Yeah. And others would say a problem for President Bush is that there's nothing in the bill that reflects his passions, the guest worker plan, the path to citizenship. Is this going to be seen as just a political maneuver a few days before Election Day?
Well, frankly, I think that's exactly what it's intended to be. I think Republicans in both chambers are hoping that this will provide a boost to some candidates out there on the campaign trail, and Republican staffers on the Hill are very open about that. But it was clear that the president was a little tight-lipped about the whole thing. He stressed that he wants a temporary worker program and that he's looking forward to working with Congress on finding some sort of middle ground to deal with the 12 million illegal immigrants estimated to be in the country.
And we remind ourselves that the House and the Senate were very divided on this issue, passed very different bills. What is the thinking about the upcoming election and a possible shift in Congress? You know, which might benefit the president? I mean, is it thought that Democrats, if they increase their numbers after Election Day, might actually help push forward the president's plan?
Ironically, yes. I mean, they still would have quite an uphill battle. I mean, they would legislatively be starting from scratch because they can't use the same bills, and they would face the same hurdles from lawmakers who are very against amnesty, as they call it. So it wouldn't be smooth sailing, but it might be a bit easier for the president.
As you said, ironically. Nicole Gawet, staff writer for the Los Angeles Times in Washington, D.C. Nicole, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, today we want to take a look at U.S. troops through several lenses. In a moment, one of the growing number of older Americans taking advantage of the new higher age limit to sign up for the Army. But first, there's a new website set up by an active duty sailor. It's called Appeal for Redress, and other active duty service members can log on to protest the war in Iraq with these words: "As a patriotic American proud to serve the nation in uniform, I respectfully urge my political leaders in Congress to support the prompt withdrawal of all American military forces and bases from Iraq." Well, the creator of this controversial website is Navy Seaman Jonathan Hutto, and he joins us now. Jonathan, welcome.
Thank you.
What was your thinking behind this website?
The thinking behind this website was to find a way within the legal structure of the military for active duty members, National Guard and Reserve, to get engaged in ongoing discussion and dialogue and debate in our country around what's the best direction in Iraq. We've heard from, many segments of the society, but we haven't heard from that segment that actually volunteers, joins, and is deployed, some even their second and third tours, and who are bearing the hardest and most immense sacrifice. That's our active duty men and women.
I'm sure you've heard from critics who've said that if an army isn't unified, if troops aren't unified with one sense of purpose, regardless of how they feel about the politics, that it jeopardizes the troops.
Well, being unified and being uniform are two totally different things. What I mean by that is one has to make a distinction between following an order, which we're all sworn to do, in which this appeal is not jeopardizing in any sense, and then expressing what your own personal reservations are, your own personal views, and your own personal misgivings on your own personal time.
Yeah.
There is a difference there.
What have you heard from your bosses?
I heard directly from my public affairs officer today. This was the first time that anyone officially on behalf of the United States Navy spoke to me, and he appreciated the fact that I'm not trying to use the Navy to make my statements, that I'm not doing this during my duty time, that I'm not wearing my uniform, and that I'm not saying anything malicious about our leadership in Washington, what have you. So he felt that it was a legal initiative, and that he appreciated the way we were carrying out and conducting ourselves.
What are you hearing from your fellow troops?
I'm hearing support, and I'm hearing that right on. This is a good initiative.
They sign up with their names. How do you verify that they are active duty troops?
Well, we're actually going through a verification process right now. Mm-hmm. But as it stands, we have 225. If you want to say unverified, then you can say that. But we're basically going to have to call the services just to make sure.
The website says staying in Iraq will not work and is not worth the price. It's time for U.S. troops to come home. What happens if you are sent to Iraq?
If I'm sent to Iraq, then I go. I have a sworn duty and a sworn obligation. So if I'm told to go, I will go. But that doesn't change my thoughts.
You've had critics, Senator Jack Reed of Rhode Island, who is actually leading Democratic opposition to the war during this election campaign. He's a West Point grad, a former Army Ranger, a paratrooper, and he says, if you feel the course of action is inappropriate, you should get out of the service.
Okay. We just have to fundamentally disagree with that statement. I don't think armed services is no different from civilian life. I mean, the expectation that we'll all be monolithic and think that the same thoughts is, to me, outrageous. Furthermore, I think it flies in the face of democracy. If anything, members of the military should be very active because they're the ones who go out and defend the democracy that the rest of Americans enjoy.
Jonathan, I want to thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Navy Seaman Jonathan Hutto, creator of the controversial website Appeal for Redress, where active duty service members can register their opposition to the war in Iraq. Well, while some active duty troops are criticizing the war, older recruits are signing up in record numbers since the Pentagon raised the maximum age of enlistment in the Army from 35 to 42 last March. John Robinson is from South Attleboro, Massachusetts. On November 7th, he'll turn 40 and he'll spend his birthday at Fort Sill in Oklahoma, diving into basic training in the U.S. Army Reserve, and he joins us now. Hi, John.
Hello, how you doing?
I'm fine, and we want to ask you why you decided to join. I know you don't want to talk specifically about financial incentives, but tell us, did they play a part?
There definitely are financial incentives for people that want to go in. It wasn't an incentive to me. That wasn't part of why I went in.
So what was? Why did you join up?
Many different reasons. Retirement, That's the right thing to do at the right time for the country, and make myself a little more marketable later on.
Well, to start with retirement, what do you mean by that? Is that medical benefits?
Medical benefits, then if I do, if I complete 20 total overall, then I'll have a pension.
Yeah, and you don't have a chance of having those now. What's your job?
I'm a mechanic. Right. Not many pensions in the industry for mechanics.
Nope. And tell us about this idea of wanting to be a part of something, you know, the patriotic arm of this.
Well, to go, you know, serve the country.
You know, a lot of the older enlistees are saying this, that they felt left out of a mission, really, after 9/11 because of their age. Do you have a sense of that?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I just want to be part of what's going on right now.
Even when you see the news that we see, you know, October, for instance, the highest death toll for American soldiers since 2003, that doesn't discourage you?
It doesn't make me happy, but no, it doesn't discourage me.
Yeah. What about your wife? I'm wondering, what does she say about your enlisting?
Nah, she's not very thrilled, but she deals with it because she knows it's something I want to do, and financially we're secure. I have all the insurance that we need in case anything does happen to me. Yeah. She's not going to be left high and dry. You know, what's going to be left for us later on when I go to retire? Who knows? Are we going to have Medicare, Medicaid? Are we going to have Social Security? At least we can have some VA benefits.
And I just want to, there was one other item you mentioned. Are you hoping, too, that this training that you're going to get might get you a better job than the one you have now?
It may, yeah. I mean, I'm not looking forward to cranking a wrench for the rest of my life. It's not something I want to do forever.
Okay, well, you know, as you said, you're bearing down on 40. Do you feel physically prepared for the challenge?
I'm pretty close. If I'm not there where I need to be, I'm sure the Army will make sure that they've put me there.
Yeah. How about the mental challenges? You know, are you ready, for instance, to take orders from someone who might be 20 years younger than you, or you know, to hang around with guys that are all, and women, all younger than you?
Yeah, that's not a problem for me. I work with a company of all younger people than me.
I'm wondering, too, if you think maybe your age might help them in some way.
Absolutely. I think I bring a lot to the table for the younger people here at the company that I work for, and hopefully that'll be the case in the Army.
Yeah. What about those who might say, though, is it fair to them, you're being older, you might end up being a burden on them?
A burden?
Yeah, well.
I think, I don't think a burden is, no, I don't think so. I think, if anything, I'm an asset more than a burden.
What do you tell your 8-year-old about what you're doing?
That's a good question. Well, I told her everything that I, you know, everything that you would tell your spouse, you try to go into a little more depth with your 8-year-old. Possibility I might go to Iraq. Possibility something might happen to me in Iraq.
And you look at her and you don't have second thoughts.
I look at her and that strengthens it a little bit more for me to go and do it.
Because?
Because of her.
Mm-hmm. John Robinson, new recruit for the U.S. Army Reserve. He'll begin his basic training next month on his 40th birthday. John, in advance, happy birthday and good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, take care.
All right, bye-bye.
So what shape is the Army in and what kind of impact will older recruits have? In a moment, we're going to talk with a military analyst who says this isn't your grandfather's Army and 40 isn't your grandfather's 40. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Before the break, we heard from John Robinson, a Massachusetts man who's joined the Army Reserve at the age of 40. Well, here to talk with us about this new trend in military recruitment is John Pike. He directs GlobalSecurity.org, a defense research group in Alexandria, Virginia. And John, you heard what John Robinson had to say. Do you think he's going to make it as a soldier?
Well, it looks like the Army thinks he's going to make it as a soldier. I mean, the Army is investing upwards of $100,000 in the training of every recruit that goes in. Somebody in a technical specialty, like it sounds like he's going into, they would be paying any more, even more than that. The Army is not going to invest that kind of money in somebody that they think has a high potential to wash out.
Well, and you know, we understand that the number of older recruits has dramatically increased across the country, jumping 92%. And probably many of them are listening to me and saying, I'm in better shape than a 25-year-old couch potato. But, of course, it's about more than physical shape. basic training, you know, it can be pretty, you know, pretty demoralizing. How do you think older people, older recruits, are mentally disposed to soldiering?
Not everybody is cut out to be a soldier. And the first thing that you learn about the Army is that there's the right way, the wrong way, and the Army way. And basic training is basically there to set you on the course of doing things the Army way.
You know, are older people less able to do that? You're pretty, you know, you've learned a few things by the time you're 40.
Well, some people would be and some people wouldn't. And again, that's one of the reasons that they're going to give them a battery of tests to try to get some predictability as to how they're going to respond.
Why do you think there's such an increase in older recruits?
Well, I think that there were a lot of people who wanted to join the Army but hadn't been able to.
That's what they're saying, that because of the age cutoff, they couldn't before.
Yes, it is a way to learn skills. It is a way to get economic benefits. Now, before the war came along, that was basically the sales pitch that the Army was giving. And a couple of years ago, they had a recruiting problem because saying that going to Iraq and getting shot at is a good career move is not a very compelling sales pitch. Mm-hmm. So more recently, the Army is rolling out new advertising campaigns stressing the belonging, the mission, the satisfaction in being something, part of something larger than yourself, doing something that's important. They're stressing those themes a lot more, and the Army does not have a recruiting problem now. This is certainly the recruiting pitch that the Marine Corps has had all along. And when you saw a couple of years ago that the Marines did not have a recruiting problem and the Army did, you knew that the problem was not the war, that the problem is the difference in the way the Army and the Marines were being presented to potential recruits. The Marines were saying, the few, the proud, the Marines. And that was a sales pitch that was working.
Not learn how to fly a plane or whatever, you know, some.
Right, exactly.
Right. In addition to expanding the recruitment to include older recruits, the Army is also accepting recruits with no high school diplomas, the lower aptitude test marks, past criminal records. So are you concerned about the quality of the military?
Well, you have to be concerned about it because we've seen some of these indictments of people that, in retrospect, you do have to wonder how they managed to get into the Army. They have to make a trade-off here between accepting people that in peacetime they would have been able to pass over against having enough soldiers to fight this war.
John Pike, he directs globalsecurity.org. As you look at this group, you know, people are living longer than they ever were before. You know, what do you think overall of this trend of older people? I mean, maybe this is just a natural response to the fact that people who are 40 are, you know,
are a lot younger than they used to be.
Yeah.
40 years old in the 21st century is not the 40 years old that we had a century ago. People have had much better health care at a much earlier age. They've managed to lead healthier lives. And so a 40-year-old today is not what a 40-year-old would have been, say, at the time of World War II.
John Pike directs globalsecurity.org, a defense research group in Alexandria, Virginia. What are some of your other thoughts on this topic, John?
Well, while the other John was reluctant, understandably, to discuss the specific incentives that have been provided for soldiers to enlist, those can range anywhere from in the neighborhood of $10,000 signing bonus for somebody who's going to sign up for an initial hitch to well over $100,000 for a special operations operator who's going to reenlist. So the government has definitely understood that the value of the king shilling today is going to have to be more than it was 10 or 20 years ago.
Huh. How do you think the all-volunteer Army is shaping up to the one of previous years, the draft army?
Well, they're very different armies. The all-volunteer force, of course, is drawn from people who want to be in the military, and the draft army was not. The flip side to that, of course, is that the number of people today who have had military experience and who understand the military as an institution obviously is vastly less than it was back when we had a draftee force. And certainly you have to be concerned about the possibility of the military drifting away from American society. The positive part about the Army is that they stress Army values, that the Army is an institution with high standards of integrity. The flip side to that is that that can transform itself into a disdain for the society that they are defending, an alienation from that society. There are a lot of people who simply don't have contact with the military, have never gotten stuck in traffic behind a convoy, don't have a local military museum that they kids can go play on, and for whom the military is something fundamentally alien. And so you do have to worry that without a draft, with an all-volunteer force, that the military and America are drifting apart from each other.
John, thank you so much.
Thank you.
John Pike, again, he directs GlobalSecurity.org, a defense research group in Alexandria, Virginia. Well, what do you think about older recruits or the state of the Army in general? Our email address is letters@here-now.org, or you can give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. We'd love to hear from you. Well, we have this quick update on a story we've been following. It's being called the biggest change in co-ed classrooms in over 30 years. This week, the Education Department issued new guidelines giving local public school officials more authority to create single-sex classes for students who want them. Education Secretary Margaret Spelling says that some students may learn better in single-sex education environments. Critics maintain that separating the sexes in the classroom can create inequality in education. It's a story we'll continue to follow. Stay with us. Much more today, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. Some liberal activist groups are playing a shame game with House Democrats, urging candidates with big campaign war chests to share their wealth with candidates in close races. MoveOn.org is rallying its members to call or email about 70 House Democrats, topping the list Massachusetts Congressman Marty Meehan with about $5 million in campaign funds. MoveOn wants Meehan to donate a third of that to other candidates. About a dozen Democrats have increased their contributions, including Congressman Barney Frank of Massachusetts. It's 4th District, and he joins us on the line now. And Congressman, welcome.
Thank you.
And we know you decided recently to donate much more money to both the campaign committee and to candidates. And help us understand how this works. As a congressman, you pay dues to the party out of money you've raised. You also give directly to campaigns. So start with dues. How does that work?
The dues are voluntary, and frankly, we're a little disadvantaged, although it's one I would like to be at, morally, from the Republicans. They take the amount you give to the party into account much more when they decide who's going to get positions of influence. We don't do that. Nancy Pelosi urges us to give, but basically that has not been a factor at all in who becomes either the senior member of the committee or, if we win, the chairman. In my case, I had previously not raised a lot of money because I have been fortunate enough and haven't had serious races for over 20 years. But when I became the senior Democrat, the minority leader, in effect, of the Financial Services Committee, I was asked to give $300,000 every 2 years to the committee. So I said, yeah, that's fair, and I will. I'm a beneficiary of our doing well. So I actually, earlier this year, had given them a little bit more than that. But then, frankly, what happened was there was a man who said he was going to be running against me, as he did 2 years ago, but he was somewhat disorganized and couldn't manage to qualify for the ballot. So as of September 19th, I found that I was not going to be opposed. I had thought until then that I would be, and I might have to spend some money in that campaign. And then, frankly, the excitement of this race has generated more money, so I suddenly found myself raising much more money than I had previously raised, partly, frankly, because people see that I might be chairman of the committee that supervises the banks and securities industry. And as I've said, I have suddenly found that I've acquired a lot of new friends without having to get any nicer.
Well, why do you think some of your other colleagues are sitting on some of their huge war chests? We mentioned Marty Meehan. He says he's paid his dues. He is helping other candidates raise money, and he wants the people who have given him money to know that their money goes to him, you know, where
I disagree with him. He's obviously entitled to his own views. First place, when I raise money, I tell people I'm not raising this for me myself. I'm raising it to help others as well, and I don't think anybody who gives to anybody in Massachusetts. We haven't had a seriously contested partisan race for Congress in Massachusetts since 1996. What's happened is, as the Republican Party has moved further and further to the right, they've really made it virtually impossible for Republicans to win for the House and Senate. They can win at some state races because they can separate themselves from the national. So I think everybody who gives thinking that there may be some sharing. And by the way, Congressman Meehan, I think he has given some to other people, so he hasn't held it all to himself. I think he's being a little unfair to himself when he says that.
But how tough does this get? Because we know there's a lot of arm-twisting going on. You mentioned Nancy Pelosi trying to get Democrats to pay their dues. Some haven't, and some have even said, Dennis Kucinich comes to mind, there are some Democrats who are going to raise money and some of us raise issues, which seems to put an unfair burden on the Democrats who can raise money.
Well, I think that's an inconsistency. That's a contradiction I don't see. I think I raise issues and money. It's like saying, no, I'm sorry, I don't. I prefer Thursday to ice cream. I mean, it's just not a logical comparison. There's no conflict between the two. And by the way, in terms of raising money for others, sure, we all do that as well. And I've been doing a lot of appearances for other people. You asked me why people are holding it back. Let me tell you in part why I think it is. Look, in 2004, when it looked like John Kerry might get elected president, there was going to have to be a special election for the Senate. And four of us in the House were thinking about running, Ed Markey, Marty Meehan, and myself, and Steve Lynch. And frankly, at the time, people said to me, well, you don't have any money. You're at a disadvantage. I only had a couple hundred thousand in the bank. Others had millions. So I said, well, yeah, you're right. I think I better raise some money in case I have to run for the Senate. So to be honest, earlier this year, I was stepping up my fundraising, in part because of the possibility that John Kerry will again run for president. And if he does run for president this time, he's also up for the Senate in 2008. He can't do both. So I'd been raising money, frankly, in part to have some money for the Senate. But then it became clear that we have a very real chance to win the House and that the major problem we face is maybe this flood of Republican money. So as it became clear that I wasn't going to have an opponent and that I was raising more money, I decided I would just significantly step up what I gave to the party. I do think that some of my colleagues are holding back because they're anticipating that there might be a Senate election and money will be very helpful if they're running for the Senate. Frankly, I think at this point, my own sense was the people who give you the money are out there watching, and I think they're prepared to say, well, you know what, I admire the fact that you gave to others. I'm going to support you the next time.
Barney Frank, Congressman of Massachusetts. Barney, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And we want to note that we invited Congressman Marty Meehan on the program, but he declined. But we do welcome Jeff Zeleny, a political correspondent for The New York Times. And Jeff, tell us, you know, Barney Frank just saying it's the Republicans who really strong-arm people into giving to maintain, you know, committee chairs, and Democrats don't do that as much. What do you think?
I think this year may be at the beginning of a possible exception to that. I had a conversation with Congressman Franks a month ago, I think, on the last week of the session, and he told me that that some of his fellow Democrats were really being felt squeezed. And how it works among Democrats this year, they have set up a very elaborate system. There are spreadsheets, Excel, you know, documents and whatnot. It chronicles exactly to the penny how much the Democratic member of Congress has in their bank account and how much they have given to the committee.
Sort of a report card.
It is indeed, and the most recent one I've seen, which was as of earlier this week, a lot of Democrats are not passing. Almost 40% of Democrats have not paid their dues to the Congressional Campaign Committee. There are people like Congressman Franks who have exceeded that, but a lot of Democrats have not contributed. And some say, look, our contributions are directed to us specifically. You know, they're not intended. People in our district are not expecting them to go to other Democrats. But frankly, some of them are holding on to their balances for other reasons.
Yeah, well, I'm thinking, too, that this strong-arming that's going on, showing the spreadsheets, trying to get some of the Democrats to pay up, could really become an issue if there are very tight squeaker races that could have used a little more money and the Democrats lose.
And that's the specific argument that that people like MoveOn.org and other bloggers are using, saying we did not expect this race to be this competitive in the 11th hour. If we have a little bit more money, if Democrats have a little bit more money, they can expand the playing field, if you will, and people can have the chance of being more competitive. You know, they can put on that last television ad. They can send out that last flyer of mail. But the reason this is happening is because of the change in campaign finance law. This is the first midterm election where soft money is not allowed by the committees. Hmm. So the committees are turning to the members themselves.
This is how they get that money.
Yep. For their ads and their last-minute efforts.
Jeff Zeleny, a political correspondent for The New York Times. Thanks so much for speaking with us, Jeff.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Here and Now. Well, we've been talking about U.S. troops today, and today a 23-year-old Marine from Sturbridge, Massachusetts, is being buried. Marine Second Lieutenant Joshua L. Booth died last week when he was hit by a single sniper shot in Haditha. Booth is one of nearly 100 American troops killed in Iraq this month. That's the highest monthly death toll for Americans in nearly 2 years. Here now's Kurt Nickisch has his story.
Sitting on their living room couch in Sturbridge, Deborah and Jack Booth remember their son from better days, like when he was 3 years old. Deborah said it was Christmas Eve when her husband tripped over a rope tied from the kitchen table to the door to the garage.
We still didn't know exactly what was going on, and the next morning, Josh comes running down, and instead of looking for his presents, he's looking in the kitchen because he had set a trap for Santa Claus, and he was wondering if he'd caught him.
The boy, who cared more about wrapping up Saint Nick than unwrapping gifts, took everything so seriously. His sister, Melissa DeVera, remembers.
He was such a boy, because he was always following me around and wanting to do what I wanted to do. And I remember as a kid having a party at the house, and Josh was the one running around the party with the flashlight, pointed at everybody's feet, making sure everybody had their shoes off. And if they didn't have their shoes off, he'd go get my parents, so my parents would make sure no one was in the house with their shoes on. He was just the annoying little brother that you were just like, ugh.
His dad, Jack, a history buff, gave some direction to that energy. Josh was captivated by American history. He worked at Old Sturbridge Village, the recreated New England town, and he was fascinated by the Civil War. His father remembers a report Josh gave in second grade.
He had me dress him up as General Lee, and we said, well, Josh, you know there might be a problem going on the bus as General Lee. And he said, no, no problem, Dad. And so that's just the way he was.
By high school at St. John's in Shrewsbury, Josh Booth had his jaw set for the Marine Corps. He even turned down a college scholarship from the Army to go instead to the Citadel in South Carolina for its ties to the Corps. His mother says Josh always did things the hard way.
I was in awe of him. I mean, it's funny to be in awe of your own child, but I really was. Where he got the focus, I've never seen him prouder than the day he was commissioned a Marine.
2 days later, he married Erica Rust from Dighton. Their daughter, Grace, was born in August last year. His family says Josh was as happy as a father as he was a Marine. Father Jack remembers how Josh wore his dress blues to the wedding of another serviceman and carried Grace around when she got cranky.
Here's this guy who, prior to this, he'd been stiff as a board, and now all of a sudden here he is making goofy, googly-eyed faces like Goofy or Pluto at this little baby, and every time he'd do it, she'd start laughing like crazy. She just absolutely adored him.
That's evident in the home videos the family gathered to watch this week.
I'm recording video.
Okay.
Josh taped this one in April.
Great. Gaga.
The last time Josh saw his daughter, September, when he left for Iraq, his first tour. He told his family it was more dangerous than they could imagine, and even asked his 11-year-old nephew to be a father figure to his daughter, Grace. Josh's sister, Melissa DeVera, says she could hear the gravity in his voice when he phoned her from Haditha.
When Josh was little, this is embarrassing, but he used to call me Sissy. And I hadn't heard him call me that since he was probably 10. And he said, I love you, Sissy.
Josh's mother, Deborah Booth, says her son's devotion to the military gives her comfort.
There is nothing about this that doesn't make me proud. I'm not angry. I suppose I should be, but I just know him. In his 23 years, I can honestly say he lived the way he wanted to, and we let him do that. And he died the way he would have wanted to die.
A sniper's bullet killed Marine Second Lieutenant Joshua Booth while he was leading his platoon on foot patrol through Haditha last week. Before deploying, he made one final arrangement with his wife in case he died, choosing the name of their next child. His wife's pregnant with a son. Tristan Joshua Booth is due after Christmas.
Our story was produced by Here and Now's Kurt Nickisch. Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. 30 years ago, Martin Scorsese's critically acclaimed film Taxi Driver introduced audiences to a nighttime cabbie who ultimately lost his mind working the streets in a city rife with corruption. Well, aside from showcasing the talents of a young actor named Robert De Niro, the movie gave us a glimpse into the coarse reality of a profession that many of us don't think much about. Well, producer Aaron Henkin decided to spend some time with a real-life, longtime cab driver, one who's seen more than his share of the streets of Baltimore, to try to find out how he preserved his sanity.
You must see quite a parade of humanity every day, driving around these streets.
Sometimes it's just like an HBO movie.
James Gant will introduce himself to you as Ak Adama. He's a driver for Baltimore's Blue Cab Company, and he's got an incredible sense of calm about him, especially considering the chaotic and gritty streets that he navigates every day on the job.
So how long have you been doing this?
I've been doing this for 30 years, Aaron, off and on. Used to be a correction officer.
No kidding.
Yeah. I also did this part-time while I was a correction officer.
What got you inspired to start driving a cab?
Money. Money. This is the type of job you can come out the house with 12 cents in your pocket, and 15 hours you may have $175. It depends on the day.
There's a small library of books stacked on Ox's dashboard, including the Quran and a book about the health benefits of garlic. Next to his cab driver's certification badge, a black and white photo is wedged. It's a picture of Malcolm X with a spiritual third eye taped to his forehead. Ock watches the road from behind dark sunglasses, and he smiles sarcastically from under his gray beard when he rolls past a police cruiser.
Cab companies in this city has something with the police department. It's called Taxi on Patrol, and this is where cab drivers see a crime, we report it. So we're the eyes for the Baltimore City Police Department. But we don't get no respect from the police. And I know why. Because the majority of the fleet cab drivers in this town are foreign. Nigerians, Jamaicans, Ethiopians. So the police definitely profiles us.
It seems like there are a lot of cards stacked against you if you're a guy trying to make a living driving a cab. There's the antagonistic relationship with the police, the price of gas, the fact that most drivers lease their vehicles from a fleet, which means that the first $75 you make on any given day goes directly back to the cab company. And then there's the prospect of getting held up or attacked.
I was curious about like what cab companies' policies are about like who you must and aren't obliged to pick up. I mean, is it up to your discretion about like whether or not, I mean, if there's some guy standing covered with blood holding a shotgun, you probably don't have to pick him up.
On a slow night, I'll pick him up. I'll pick up Frankenstein on a slow night.
Have you had, like, episodes where someone's tried to threaten you or rob you?
Every night, Aaron. Every night. Somebody just threw a brick at me last night. Put a dent in the side of the cab.
Just out of the blue?
Yeah, just out of the blue. You know, in the hood. They throw a rock, a bottle at you, and it's called a ghetto grenade. I don't know, it must be the light or the taxi makes them want to throw something at a taxi.
It must feel like thankless work sometimes.
Every day.
What keeps you persistent at it? There must be some sort of appeal to it.
Yeah, 45 minutes from living in the street. How's that?
Ock believes fundamentally that he and his fellow cab drivers get no respect from anyone, period. Customers think of them as almost subhuman automatons. It's an interesting prejudice, especially because it has the effect of making people feel like they can speak about their lives with absolutely no self-censoring.
I picked up a guy one night, and he was picked him up over his girlfriend's house. He was married. And he was telling me what he was doing. He was cheating on his wife, whole nine yards. And the next day, I picked that same guy up, him and his family. And he looked at me, and he felt bad. Felt bad. Because I knew.
On this weekday afternoon, Ock has been trolling up and down Pennsylvania Avenue, Utah Street, and Baltimore's Inner Harbor. We've seen tourists, car accidents, drug corners, but no one needs a ride today. Who you pick up is ultimately a roll of the dice. It could be someone who wants to pay big bucks for a ride all the way to another city. Or it could just as easily be someone who ends up hopping out of the cab and running away without paying.
Pick this guy up. He's going to Towson. He has some groceries, about 8 or 9 bags of groceries. I stopped, picked him up, going to Towson. Fare, $30. And once we get in the apartment complex, he says, I'm going in the house. I'm going to get the money. I'll be right back. Got the groceries in the back. So I said, fine. So I'm sitting out there for 20 minutes, 30, 40. Still didn't show. I said, well, that's all right. I got his groceries. So I drove back into the city, went home, went in the back of the cab to get the groceries to take in the house, and it was 8 bags of garbage. Yeah, they played the tricks. They played the tricks.
Have you ever thought about doing limousine driving? I imagine that's kind of a different sort of gig.
Oh, man, I don't have the persona for that. You know, the suit, the white tie, jumping out, opening and closing doors for people. I don't have that. But driving a cab, you have your freedom. You know, you work when you want to. You have no one to answer to. No, not a limousine.
I'm sure everybody asks you if you've watched the movie Taxi Driver.
Oh, that's one of my favorite. You talking to me? You talking to me? You talking to me? One of my favorites.
Ock has been riding around the city now for an hour without snagging a single fare. He seems amused that I'm so surprised at how hard it is to get a customer. The fact is, after he drops me off, he'll stay in this cab for another 14 hours working the streets. He'll pull an all-nighter. He'll have a busy stretch after a ball game gets out downtown. He'll make some decent money. And at the end of his shift, he'll make the mistake of parking illegally. He'll come back out to the street after a few hours, and he'll find that his cab has been impounded. Ock says it's desperation that makes someone drive a cab. But it seems like there's also something in it for a man who embraces his sense of independence and his feelings of alienation with equal fervor. It almost seems like an act of faith.
Like I say, man, driving a cab is like fishing. You got to be lucky, you know? You got to be lucky. That's all it is. It's all about luck. Frustration, too. Frustration.
Our story on taxi driver James Gant, a.k.a. Ock Adama, was produced by Aaron Henkin. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Manigan, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, Alex Ashlock, Karen Miller-Medson, Hitesh Hathi, and Virginia Prescott. Doug Sugertz is our engineer. Our web producer is Ken George. Our intern, Katie Falsigno. Our managing editor is Chris Ballman. The senior producer of Here and Now is Kathleen McKenna. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.